This presentation was recorded at the Western Fellowship Teachers Institute. For more information about the Institute, call 541-999-7467 or email jolasmucker@gmail.com. That's jolasmucker@gmail.com.
Well, hello and welcome to this class about discerning between disability and misbehavior. How many of you that taught last year felt that you probably had some students that had inability, disability? All right. How many of you had some students that had some misbehavior or unwillingness relating to academics? Okay. So it is a very practical subject. This is something that I expect to be dealing with this year, and I expect that you will be too. I don't have a handout today, so I'm a little bit concerned. Frankly, I'm a little bit concerned about how passive these meetings can be. You can come here with your coffee, and I do it too, and we sit there and we listen and we drink, and that's good. That's good. But I did not provide any paper today, so I'm hoping that you can leave with something, though. When a facilitator of a class like this gives a paper, well, then at least they know that their folks are going out with something. I'm going to write two words on the board, and I want to hear some discussion about them. Disability and inability. Same? Different? For our consideration today, are they the same? Is there differences? What do you think?
Inability indicates, I believe, a lack of knowledge, whereas disability indicates more the lack of ability, maybe. That's not a very good word to use since it's in the word. Yeah. But just not being able to do it because of, not because of knowledge, but just because of some of the problem.
Okay.
Is inability, too, that you just plain can't do it, period, zero, zilch? And disability, maybe you can limp along?
Maybe that aspect.
The word that had come to my mind, I forgot. It was hindrance. Disability is a hindrance.
Okay.
No, it's not a statement of whether of what a person can do. Inability is, well, I just can't do it. And I can't draw, but I see that as an inability, not a disability.
Okay. Does that match your definitions, folks? Is that? Are you going, yeah, that's the way I always thought about it? Okay.
I was just thinking, maybe to clarify, when we disable something, right, it's capable of doing something, but because we pulled out some connection, we disabled it. Whereas something that's unable of doing it is like, it's not even built for that. Like, you can't plow with a combine.
Got it. That resonates deeply with me. If you look these two words up in a dictionary, Webster's doesn't really make a difference. I went and looked this morning. I didn't get that much guidance out of the whole thing. Someone commented about the number of ladies we have to men, but now the men are doing all the talking, so this is really getting imbalanced. Here's your
That's
chance.
That's a disability on that side.
That's a disability? Well, now I would have had indications from previously in this conference that it wouldn't be correct. Okay. Well, I think maybe for the sake of focus here and everybody thinking together, I'm going to try to drive a few stakes about where I'm coming at, how I'm coming at this subject. Is that fair enough? If the dictionary didn't provide a lot of guidance, well, then maybe I'll provide some. But when I think of disability, I think of the things that Joan Martin is addressing and the things that she has dedicated much of her efforts towards diagnosing, ADSS, dyslexia, that type of thing. All right. Inability, I would look at more as I don't have the knowledge. I think John had mentioned something. I don't have the apperception. I haven't learned how to do
basic math functions, so therefore I can't do this new lesson in math. Perhaps it'd be inability, or maybe I just am not able to actually make the mental connections that need to be made to understand the lesson. That's sort of the way I'm looking at it. Okay. When I think of disability, I think of wheelchairs. We call those people disabled. All right. We don't call them enabled. We don't have enabled parking. We have disabled parking. Parking for the people that are disabled, that are handicapped. Now, what is the word that's used in your course description? I think it's disability. I'll just be right up front with you. I'm not planning to address this from a disability thing. If you want disability lessons, ladies especially, you can go hear from Joan Martin. I'm coming at this more we're sort of in an either or situation here. The title suggests that when we have encountered difficulty in the classroom, the student is not learning, then it's our responsibility to figure out, do we have inability, and not so much diagnosing whether this person has dyslexia. Okay, that's not really the course that we're headed. Or on the other hand, do they have unwillingness? Is it some attitude problem? Is it maybe, the classic laziness problem? Okay, so that's where I'm coming from today, thinking more about inability because of apperception, because of being unable to learn. Now, I guess that could include disability, a learning disability, as in the wheelchair thing. Or is it misbehavior, as in unwillingness? Is that clear enough? Is that a fair premise? All right. Well, I think with that, then we're going to move along. Thanks for your graciousness and allowing me just to bend things around the way I wanted it there. but if you want another title for this whole consideration, I would simply give it this: having a heart for your students. You see, as we're teaching, as we're in front of our classes, we need to be reading our students. And we take great inspiration from Jesus, the master teacher. But one thing Jesus did not have to do that we must do is we must try to figure out what's going on in here. Are we working with an attitude problem? Is that why they're not able to get the lesson? Is it an attitude issue? Is it misbehavior? Is it unwillingness? Or is it that they didn't get a lesson back there somewhere that they should have, and now here they are, and they don't have that row of bricks, they don't have that course of bricks, and we're trying to lay on top of that. See? That's what we need to be trying to ascertain. That's what we need to be reading our students and understanding what is going on in there. And I really don't think that Jesus knew all things, you know. He didn't have to try to figure that out, because he knew it. And in fact, it says in the scriptures various places, he knowing the heart said, or knowing what they were thinking said, boom, and he got them right between the eyes without them even giving any outward indication. We can't do that. We can't do that. However, we do want to draw from Jesus relating to people today. We are going to be reading two passages from the scripture in just a little bit. I asked one teacher in relation to this topic what ought to be said. It's a teacher that taught a lot longer than I have, and I thought probably was doing a pretty good job of this. And this is what he said. Two words. Uh-oh. He said, you can't really talk about that. He said, it's too nebulous. It just doesn't fit in neat boxes. So it's a whole bunch of things that aggregate together to create a situation. And a lot of those things that are aggregating together are just little tiny things. Okay, and so that's what we're talking about today, really. These twin problems look pretty much alike, pretty much the same. It's not like this is red ketchup and this is yellow mustard, and this one tastes like tomatoes and this one tastes like mustard. Okay, so, you know, it's not quite that way. It's a little bit more nebulous than that. But it is important to interpret the signs that the students are giving, because the way you relate to it and the way that you respond to it can make all the difference. I well remember when I was in fifth grade, I got a paperback, and this is what it said across the top. I forget, the grade was horrible. I'm glad I forget the grade. But I do not forget what was written there. It says, Jonathan, do you know what you lack? And then in big letters, much bigger letters, it said, effort. All right? My teacher was right. Right on. And I redid the lesson. That's all she wrote. She didn't say redo and hand in by tomorrow. She didn't say that. It just said, you lag effort. Okay. What I did is I redid the paper and I handed it back in with a note that says, I do not want to lack effort. Okay. Please give me a second chance. I don't remember what she did exactly with that. I don't know. All right. There was a teacher that was observing the signs and she hit me in the way that I needed to be hit. Rather than if it was inability. Have you ever been doing something and doing your best and someone came along and rather unceremoniously bumps you out of the way and takes over and kind of makes you feel like, I don't know, what a pipsqueak for even trying? Did that ever happen to you? I can think of some times it did. When I, my first job out of school, the brother that I worked for was kind of known behind his back as slave driver. Very, very aggressive environment there at work. There were some things that he expected us to do that I had never done before. And I remember one time I was there trying to do something and he came and literally bumped into me and pulled the tool out of my hands and set to it and said, this is the way you do it. You know, and I remember that. I remember that today. And it's what I don't want to do with my students. It's what I don't want you to do with your students either. I was unable. My effort, I believe, I will stand to this day and say my effort was impeccable. But I was simply unable. I'm trying to illustrate, folks, that you need to be reading the signs and hopefully interpreting them accurately so that you can serve your students in a way that is truly effective. I had a ninth grade girl that was all messed up about reading history. I can't read. When I read this history, well, you know, words are swimming and blah, 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 and takes so much time and on and on and on. And we tried to, you know, tried to help, and things got worse. And after a while, we're sitting down with the parents about her problem of reading history. This is not really what you want. And finally, we decide on a course of action that, well, she'll just kind of be expected to bump along in history and won't be required to read it, and what she gets, she gets. I wasn't satisfied with the decision, but because I was afraid it was... See, maybe I'll put this word up here. I'm going to put unwillingness up here. I thought it was unwillingness. That's what I thought it was. She convinced us it was this. And so we treated it like this. After she was married and had children of her own, she came back and said, remember that thing with history? Yeah, remember that thing with history? That was a wrong decision. I was here. And you treated me like I was here. So it was the worst thing that ever happened to me in school. Oh, wow. I think it was a confession, really. And it was a good-natured conversation. Do not get me wrong. But we tried, and we missed it, right? I want you to be able to try and hit it. And hopefully, with going through this consideration here today will help you be a little more effective. Now, the next thing I like to do is I like to open up the scriptures. I like to look at two counts, and you make some of your own conclusions about what's going to be happening. I feel the one represents this, the other represents that. Before we do that, though, we're going to pull into a little rest area. If you have any comments you'd like to make at this point, here's your chance.
Well, I just have a question. What do we as two teachers do when, as a teacher, you evaluate, I evaluate it one way, and mom and dad says, no, it's the other way. Or maybe even a group of teachers says, oh, the problem with this child is that they're just being rebellious or unwilling or whatever. And no, mom and dad said, no, they got a learning disability or they, you know, there's another issue. And you're coming at this from either side and there's a gulf in between.
Yeah, these are things that give teachers gray hairs. What do you do?
How do you deal with it? I mean, do you just let it go? Do you try to work out it from your perspective and let them work out it from their perspective and get nowhere? Do you just think it'll take care of itself?
Go ahead.
There are times, even though it's not the best thing, when you knew for that girl that you felt strongly that those unwillingness, sometimes it won't work to force the point.
Yeah.
It would make the thing worse. I think probably you accomplish something there in her coming back that you may not have accomplished. I don't know. But there are times that God has ways of doing things that may not look like the right route. But apparently she came back and realized it later. I don't know.
Yeah, this is really getting deep. It really ends up being, Wendell, what is success? looking back on that whole thing, was that a successful exchange? Did that young lady, now a young mother, looking back on that whole thing, maybe there was more learned there than if I would have stuck to my course and held her to the line.
Maybe the chances are that she'll recognize an unwillingness in her children instead of calling it an inability. I don't know. I just have to think of that.
And if that's the case, well, then God be praised, that's success.
I was going to say that children are given to the parents, not to the teachers.
Yes,
and
exactly.
The parents delegate that authority to the teachers, and if they choose to remove that option from the teachers to push the point, then we are duty-bound to honor that, whether we think it's the right decision or not.
Yes, and John's a hypothetical but yet very real-to-life scenario. I heard that about the parents. Don't go to war with the parents. If the parents are thinking that you're working with this situation, don't just fall over. You don't have to be a knockover. But we can't war with the parents, really. And when, if it's a staff discussion, that's one thing. Sitting down with parents, that's another, right? All right, let's get our Bibles open. Thank you for that. Unless there's more thought, this is more of a discussion format, and I want to respect that. Mark 10 is where I'd like to head, but if you have more you want to say, let's talk about it. All right, let's go to Mark 10, and then we're going to go to Mark 6. And I think we're just going to read the two passages, and then we'll kind of have them here on the table, and then we'll push around on them. Mark 10, of course, you can identify Jesus as a teacher, and the individual in which he's speaking will be the students. Okay, beginning at verse 17. And when he was gone forth into the way, there came one running and kneeled to him and asked him, "Good master, what shall I do that I may inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said unto him, "Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one, that is God. Thou knowest the commandments. Do not commit adultery, do not kill, do not steal, do not bear false witness, defraud not, honor thy father and mother." And he answered and said unto him, "Master, all these have I observed from my youth." Then Jesus, beholding him, loved him, and said unto him, "One thing thou lackest. Go thy way, sell whatsoever thou hast, and give to the poor. And thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come, take up thy cross, and follow me." And he was sad at that saying, and went away grieved, for he had great possession. Right, now I hope you can understand which one that is. And we're gonna dissect these passages. All right, flip back just a few pages to Mark 6. And we're going to read verse 32 through 44. Verse 32, Mark 6, 32. "And they departed into a desert place by ship privately. And the people saw them departing, and many knew him," that's Jesus, "and ran afoot thither out of all the cities, and outwent them, and came together unto him. And Jesus, when he came out, saw much people, and was moved with compassion toward them, because they were as sheep, not having a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came unto him and said, 'This is a desert place, and now the time is far past. Send them away that they may go go into the country round about and into the villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat.' He answered and said unto them, 'Give ye them to eat.' And they said unto him, 'Shall we go and buy 200 pennyworth of bread and give them to eat?' And he said unto them, 'How many loaves have ye? Go and see.' And when they knew, they say, 5 and 2 fishes. And he commanded them to make all sit down by companies upon the green grass. And they sat down in ranks, by hundreds, by fifties. And when he had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, he looked up to heaven and blessed and brake the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And the 2 fishes divided he among them all, and they did eat and were filled. And he took up 12 baskets full of the fragments and of the fishes. And they that did eat of the loaves were about 5,000 men." Well, the disciples there. The disciples. The student. All right, let's talk a little bit about some signs of unwillingness from the rich young ruler. Hop back to the previous passage. What do you see? Why do you so judge that the rich young ruler was unwilling?
power to do what Jesus asked him to do.
All right. But he didn't do it.
He didn't do it.
Yeah.
Or we don't know that he did.
Right.
Well, we sadly, he might have.
Yeah, I think that's probably encapsulates the biggest thing right there. Right? If I'm clear, you'll have 17 things till we move to the unable. I'm going to go across 17 classic signs of unwillingness. Right? These are little things, and they don't all come from this passage. But I think you've encapsulated well, Aaron, what makes us think that this man was unwilling. This was an unwilling student. The one sign here is, notice how I began with sweetness, maybe even flattery. Good master. And Jesus loved it. Jesus didn't love it. He got a rebuke. And that's what the rich young ruler wanted, right? I'm going to Jesus to get a rebuke. No, he didn't want a rebuke. What was it? Well, flattery. All right. Good master. Our students might use an unwilling student, a misbehavior. Flattery is misbehavior, see? All right. There might be some of that getting used. Beware. All right, now I'm not trying to make an elephant out of an ant here, okay? I'm just saying these are little things that aggregate sometimes. And there may be some of these missing in your particular case, but maybe just things to notice. Here's another thing. Number two, he had a wrong view of himself. And let me get to my correct passage here. Mark 10, verse 20, he says, let me get to it. Yeah, these all have I observed from my youth. All right? He basically told Jesus, you name it, I do it. See? I'm beyond reproach here. Isn't that even maybe just a bit of smugness or cockiness? I think so. It's small thinking. I doubt in reality he was as good as he was saying he was. It's maybe even a bit of a pride and unapproachableness. Right, number three in verse 20, I would call that a clever response too. A clever response. The unwilling often have clever responses. If only they put as much effort into their work as they do in trying to come give a comeback, why then good things would happen. He knew, this young man knew how to cleverly position himself to make himself look good. And one of my favorite stories of a little boy, not in a school setting, but one little boy that demonstrates a clever response. The family had a very small little dog, a terrier, and they could not let the thing out because they couldn't catch it again. It could run 90 miles an hour, plus or minus X, and you couldn't catch it. So the family rule became, you can't leave out the dog. Well, the little fellow left out the dog, 6-year-old, something like that. And he ran and ran and ran, couldn't catch the dog. Finally enlisted the help of his older brother, 18 years old, something like that. And they ran and ran and ran, still couldn't catch the dog. Finally, the older brother says to the little fellow, he says, well, should I tell Daddy? And the little fellow says, no. He said, why not? Well, he said, he'll probably spank me, and that won't bring the dog back. All right, sign number four is laziness. Laziness. We must be careful with this one. We'll talk a little bit more about this later. Be careful. Don't slap the laziness sign too soon. But you know, really, this young man, he wanted to rest on his laurels to leverage himself into good favor with the master. He came up saying, good master, what may I do? Hey, I'm a worker here. Yeah. Come on, bring it on, Jesus. You know, I'm going to work for you now. But what did he do? Nothing. Laziness. Verse 5. Grieved about the truth about himself. Grieved about the truth about himself. He was maybe even a little insulted. Verse 22, he was sad. He was grieved. So here was the truth. Here was the ultimate chest x-ray, checkup from the neck up, whatever you want to call it, Jesus gave to this young. Can you imagine being able to go to like that to Jesus today? Well, we can, but we can't do it in this real-time situation like we had right here. But here Jesus gave him the pure truth about himself, told him exactly what he must do to inherit eternal life. And what are we talking about here? We're talking about grief and insulting, or getting insulted at the truth. It's a sign of the unwilling. The same is true for unwillingness in our classrooms. We really aren't interested in the truth about themselves. The sixth sign, the unwilling eventually respond with outright rejection, unless they change course. Of course, verse 20, he went away. The two words that come out of the mouth of one who's, when the stakes get high and the realities are clear in the classroom, is, it's hard. I quit. I can't. See,
And lastly, from this passage, one wonders if he responded as he did and didn't maybe have a little bit of a sour attitude. Now, you won't find those words in here, but I'm afraid this fellow had a... I wonder. I don't want to assign a motive or an attitude to him that he didn't have, but one really wonders if he really was pure in his attitude as he walked away. Was that grief a biblical or a spiritually God-approved kind of grief? We don't know for sure, but we sort of doubt it. Now, I'm going to continue with a few more things that are specific to the classroom, perhaps about the unwilling. Bad body language, slouching, a set upper lip, yawning at the wrong times. We're talking about bad body language. All the other things that winrow into the indications of unwillingness. Another one would be just inattention, inattentive in class. Perhaps this is because they don't care. Perhaps it's because they think they already know or something like that. But the unwilling tend to be inattentive. Another, I'm at number 10 now. They may be able to do in class while you're right with them, but as soon as you turn them loose themselves, well, then everything falls flat. But then you get them up to your desk or you go to their desk, and as you stand there and do almost nothing, then they're rolling again. You must wonder about this, if they're only able to produce under pressure. Another one is blame the lesson. It's weird. I don't get it. This doesn't make sense. You know, this is dumb. Okay, watch for your response. I'm sorry, watch for their response. Yeah, watch your response too. But watch for their response when you remind them, well, look, you could do it in class. This was making sense, and you were right up there at the board with everybody else punching out the data. Now what happened? Notice how they respond. Do they meet the challenge, or does it sour them? More signs of unwillingness. Complains easily. Unwilling student will complain multiple times, more and above the ones who are really unable. The lack of predictable patterns, perhaps, can also be another one. On days, off days. All right. Depends what side of bed they get out in the morning. Another one, easily given to ennui or boredom. Right? Just bored. Bored with school, perhaps, is unwillingness. Poor conduct in other areas. The unwilling sometimes betray themselves on the playground, where they're very willing there. Another would be as a way to summarize the unwilling, as lazy as it can be and as diligent as they must. And then it becomes your decision as a teacher as to where to draw that line. Oh, I hate that kind of thing. Lazy as they can be and as diligent as they must. That's unwilling. Right? And another one that is definitely a sign of the unable is relates poorly to confusion. When there is confusion, and really there is a lot of confusion in the classroom, it's our responsibility to straighten out that confusion and make things clear. But how do they relate to confusion? I know as a youngster, I can remember the days in my unwillingness, I would just space out. I just quit. All right? That's unwillingness. But if I'm unable, a confused person who's unable, it's going to still be trying. See? All right, these are generalities, of course, not surefire methods, but I think these little nuances influence us, and these are signs we can be reading because we want to, as we said earlier, we must, and we want to be serving our students what they need. Now let's talk a little bit about the unable. We're not going to take the time to restate everything in mirror image that I just gave you, but let's look at these disciples again back to Mark 6. Especially Peter reminds me of a willing student, willing but unable. Think about when Jesus asked him, are you willing to, can you die with me? Oh, yes, no problem. And a little while later, and not that terribly long, no, I never knew the man. No, Jesus, who's he? No. But then to Jesus just before, you get the idea. There was a man who was willing but unable. All right. Back to Mark 6 again. The disciples were willing to work with Jesus, even though they didn't understand everything. And that's a blessing. That makes this account rich. To notice in Mark 6 that the general feature of this account is the disciples didn't know what Jesus was up to. I think they probably actually were scratching their heads when they went out there when Jesus said, well, go find bread for 5,000 men.
Besides the women and the children, what does Jesus expect us to find after all? A stalled semi or ox cart, whatever, you know. But they moved along with Jesus, even though they didn't understand everything. And that's a classic sign of someone who is willing, but perhaps there's confusion, but they're relating to it well. Another one is they behave somewhat predictably too. They behave like silly sheep, right? Left to themselves, this whole thing, why they would have sent all the people away, the significant learning opportunity would have gone with them, and that would have been that. Send them away, said the disciples. Give them to eat, said Jesus. All right? So the unable, yes, there's some unpredictability. They're not able to figure it out on their own, and the situation would not resolve well at all, left to themselves. Another one is they trusted their teacher and didn't argue with him. I think we talked about that long enough, perhaps, with the other one. They trusted their teacher, didn't argue. Another one is guileless. Guileless. In Mark 10's parallel account, Matthew records Peter's response when he witnessed the rich young ruler. We're back to that one now. And this is what Peter said. It says, "Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Behold, we have forsaken all and followed thee. What shall we have therefore?" Okay, that's a parallel account, right? There's a certain, do you detect that guilelessness? Jesus did not beat up on Peter. He didn't. Jesus essentially told him, "You're right. You're right." But at face value, what Peter was saying about himself and what the rich young ruler was saying about himself were almost identical. Peter was different in that he was coming from a willing heart, albeit unable sometimes. And the rich young ruler's heart, well, it was an unwilling heart, although he had positioned himself to be able. Another thing, we're talking about the hallmarks of the unable. Able to ask simple questions related to the problem at hand. I get that from verse 37. They say, well, what are we going to do with 200 pennyworth? They at least are able to comment on the obvious. And I think that we can at least rejoice if our students are asking simple questions, because they have themselves positioned then that we can move them along, as Jesus did with his disciples here. Another one, in verse 38, how many loaves have you? Go and see, Jesus said. So they're willing to expend personal effort as they can. The unwilling, the misbehavior ones, they aren't even doing what they could do. All right? But the disciples were cooperating with Jesus, willing to expend personal effort to find answers as they can. Another one is they're able to be filled. This is very basic. Verse 42, and they did all eat and were filled. You can't fill an unwilling person. Something's in the road. It's their own attitude, whatever it is, but just the fact that they were able to fill them. If you're able to fill a student, after you work with them long enough, why, if there's at least some of the right thing happening, why then think about that in your conclusions about these things. Another one comes to a satisfactory conclusion. I like verse 43. They took up 12 baskets full of fragments and of the fishes. Well, that's a satisfactory conclusion. So when you look back on it, of course, we want answers now. We can't look at the conclusion to determine what we should be doing before it's time for the conclusion. But when you're working with the unable, oftentimes it can come to a satisfactory conclusion. When you're working with the unwilling, the ones that are misbehaving, oftentimes it doesn't come to a satisfactory conclusion. And lastly, true to the pattern of the unable, they fail the next test. And I get this by reading on a little bit in Mark. You go on, and you have the account where Jesus walked on the water. And the disciples, according to Jesus' estimation of passing or failing, they failed the next test when, in verse 52 of Mark 6, it says they consider not the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened. All right. That often happens with the unable. They fail the next test. Take heart. Keep working. Keep working. Now, I want to, in the rest of the time remaining here, talk a little bit about what to do about it. Now, that's going, I hope you understand, this is extra. Because you look at the title, and it just says all we're supposed to do is discern. Okay, so now we got the label. Right, but I've noticed when I pick up a prescription, with thank the Lord, isn't very often, I go for the pill inside the bottle. I don't go for the label on the outside. So let's talk about what we can do. And again, I would like to look at how Jesus responded. And I'm not going to tell you exactly what happened in all these accounts, drawing on your own knowledge of them. I'd like to look at what Jesus did.
what did Jesus do? Number one, he was patient to both. So if you're working with this or you're working with this, be patient. That's a proper response for either one. Isn't that nice? I find that somehow reassuring. Right? Somehow my diagnostic work doesn't need to be so accurate after all. Right? Be patient with both. Yes, his patience was tried. He said in Mark 9, when working with these same disciples, the same group of students, he said, "Oh, ye faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you?" But he kept on suffering. He kept on suffering. He kept on working. Jesus worked with that rich young ruler until who walked out? Jesus walked out? No. No. The young man walked out. Patience towards both. Another thing we see is compassionate. Jesus was compassionate and loving towards both. To both the unwilling and the unable, Jesus was compassionate and loving. Closely related. Mark 6:34, let me reread. "And Jesus, when he came out, saw much people and was moved with compassion toward them, because they were as a sheep," here we go again, what we heard earlier this morning, "having no shepherd," having no shepherd. It also says of the rich young ruler, Matthew 10, "And Jesus, beholding him, loved him," loved him. The account of the rich young ruler, so full, so rich an example of the compassion of Jesus. "For a long time, I missed the unwillingness of this young man. Because I was amazed at the way Jesus related to him. But when you look at it, this man does give a lot of marks of unwillingness. But you almost miss it because Jesus is so compassionate." And that's what oozes out of the passage. Well, are we or can we be like the master teacher? Yeah, we can. With his help. See. "School teaching is a spiritual labor unlike anything I've ever done before. I did carpentry work for a slave driver. Next job, I was an electrician. I worked in a furniture shop manufacturing furniture." You're going to, please, I'm not saying this to say that I'm unstable. If you want to.
Now, we think you're skilled.
I put in time here, okay? And I worked on the sales floor of the furniture shop. Let me think, what was next? I don't know. Pump septic tanks. Right. Teaching school is unlike all of those in that it's a spiritual endeavor where you, and Not to minimize any of these other things, I think I would have been a better electrician had I allowed the Spirit of Jesus to control my spirit more when I was on the job and so on. But what I'm trying to say is that we can have the compassion, the love, the patience of Jesus Christ as we allow our hands and our hearts and our lips and our eyes and our ears and our everything be a channel, a conduit of what Jesus Christ is. You see, if we give ourselves completely to Jesus Christ, all that Jesus is, he gives to us so that we can be all that Jesus is to other people. That's pretty simple. That's Christian living. All right? Let's continue. What else was Jesus? Well, he was willing to try. He was willing to risk his time and his effort. Mark 6:34, from this passage, it's just a phrase lifting it out. It says, "And he was willing to teach them many things." Maybe if we just be a little more willing to teach the unwilling or to teach the unable, it would work out better. He was willing to teach them many things. Another thing, Jesus was in control of his emotions. Nowhere do I see Jesus getting frustrated and blowing up and giving someone a Dutch rub, knuckles on the head, or pulling them by the ear or other strange things like this. No, Jesus was in control of his emotions. Frustration is always a weakness. Patience is always a strength. Axiom for teaching, a motto that we ought to have hanging on our heart a little more. Jesus was also in control of his class. In Mark 6:39, it says, "He made him sit down by companies. They sat down in ranks. Order and discipline usually go a long way in helping both the unwilling or the unable." Both. Order and discipline. Maybe if we're frustrated about these kind of problems here on the board behind me, maybe we just need a little more order and a little more discipline. He made them sit down in ranks. Another thing Jesus was, is Jesus was a mature figure in a world of juveniles. I love to have fun with students, and I hope you do too. But somehow through it all, we need to be a mature person in a world of juveniles. We must be an adult in our whole day long, really. In our studies and in those of other studies, I ran across quote here I'd like to read. What is crucial to beginning to read is a child's attachment to an adult who spends time reading to or with a child. What is crucial to beginning to read is a child's attachment to an adult who spends time reading to or with a child. The motivation for reading is social. Right? How about the motivation to do math and English? I think it applies some to others too. Right? I think it's powerful stuff. I'm behind the concept. I'm 100% behind the concept of the teacher being a great friend and having a great time with your students. An effective teacher must still have the persona of an adult. Right? I think what this quote is telling us is that, yes, we need a social attachment to our children. It's a powerful motivator, and the academic achievement is great when that happens. And you know that's the truth, but we must act like it. Nowhere did I get the impression that Abraham didn't frolic with Isaac. I'm sure that he did. But Abraham, it also says that he was able to command his children after him. And how did he do that? Did he do that when he was laying on the living room floor, pushing Isaac up in his stocking feet? No, there was a time for that. But then there was a time not to do that, and then to be an adult and to be able to command his children. But he had that social bond, perhaps, from the stocking feet games. I think another thing we see from Jesus, he was willing to separate the learners from the crowd. Mark 6:31. Jesus did separate the learners from the press to better instruct. That's when the crowd saw them going, and then you had the feeding of the 5,000 account coming on the heels of that. There does come a time when we should take the same approach with our difficult student. Go ahead and separate them from the bunch a little bit. Have a chat. Try to figure it out. Maybe have some more one-on-one teaching. There's time for that too. There's times that we use the rod in those one-on-ones, and then there's times we use the staff. But I think we need to be very, very careful. Don't be too quick to spank for laziness, although sometimes it is a problem. But I think that we need to remember the nature of a child. It is in the nature of a child to be lazy. Uh-huh. But it is also in the nature of a child to be curious. It's also in the nature of a child to want to please. All right? And I'm afraid that if we are too quick to say, well, this child is lazy, we're forgetting the fact that this child probably does want to please you, likely. And they do want to learn because they're curious. They're not dead. The dead aren't curious, you know. So what is standing in the way? What is standing? There's a lot of things that can stand in the way, right? But I think that we just need to be careful with this. Well, my strong encouragement to bring it all together, strive to make school make sense to your students. Strive to make school make sense. You know, sometimes we know that there's bad experiences at school, and I know that my students don't always have pleasant experiences, and things don't always make sense to them. But I think we have a goal for ourselves, that we want school to make sense for our students. And that must make sense in light of larger life truths. It doesn't make sense to permit laziness. All right? And they need to understand that laziness, you won't get ahead. Disciple, discipline. They need to understand the connection between those two words. All right? But if it is inability, again, can we make the lesson make sense? That really is our job, is it not? Have a school make sense? How much a school can't make sense until something happens within the heart of the child and they just kind of like, on school. I fear a child that has done that. Right? And sometimes I wonder, you know, maybe this varies with students. Maybe some students, some more things can be confusion and confusing. And they're still okay with it. I don't know. But let's make school make sense. All right, your turn again. I'm done.
Can we create unwillingness sometimes? This one about the children are able to do it in class, but they can't on their own. I think that's one of my weaknesses, being a little too quick to help them through it rather than help them help themselves.
So it creates a misbehavior when you're there to help too quickly.
Well, helps them just back off. I can't do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the answer?
That's my problem, too.
Mm-hmm.
One of the answers is to teach more grades. If you're I'm serious. When I had taught at the Mennonite school, when I stopped teaching, my last year there was great. I taught grades 5 to 10. All right, let's say it this way. I managed or facilitated grades 5 to 10. Okay? Then I went to the Russian school. Last year that I had there, I just had 9th and 10th. We're silly. I'm silly. When I was in that situation, I wished for this situation. When I'm in this situation, I wish for that one. All right? Because this thing of actually teaching more grades, it makes you less available to the students, and you achieve this idea of independent learning easier when you're teaching multi-grades, right?
On having one more grade than you did last year.
Yes. More answers to the question. Yeah, we can make our students unable. We have a... There's a in downtown Spokane, there's a beautiful park. Well, beautiful, yeah, beautiful. The pond is really ugly, but in that pond there's ducks, and it has a sign there that says "Do not feed the ducks." And then it has an explanation under that. It said how last winter there were actually ducks that were too fat to fly south, and so it got cold, and there they are stuck. All right. A duck that doesn't learn how to forage on its own. So be careful what kind of help we give our students. That can encourage the right things to happen in relation to these terms we've been discussing. Is there more?
I like your thought about making school make sense. I think that's especially, I teach 4th and 5th, and it's pretty important to them to understand what's happening. It's pretty easy for me to forget that they don't understand. You know, just order of the day and schedule, and if we all understand what's happening, it's way less stress. That's a good point.
Just had a realization. I thought the bell was going to ring at 10:45. Okay, so we do have more time, so that's why I was about that, Aaron. Students are different. I know in my own family, one of my sons is very much oriented that he wants to know what's going to happen the next day. That's just the way he is. And before he feels comfortable lying down and going to sleep, he wants to know what's going to be going on tomorrow. Okay? And some others of our children don't have that that sense or that need nearly so keenly. So again, know your students, and if there's one that is more subject to confusion, bring them along, and you'll have to bring the whole class along. But giving individualized attention, I even think it relates to if there's a student that needs more breaks than what your systematic schedule has arranged for, let them run around the building. Just one of them. Yeah, just one of them, right? If that helps them to be able to study better, if that enables them, by all means, enable them with that run.
You have some suggestions how to wean a student that has become dependent on the teacher, overly dependent, and you determine that is the case. What are some suggestions of weaning that student off of that dependency? Maybe you've already covered that. I came in late.
No. Okay, so we have a fat duck.
You've got to get the people to quit feeding it.
Yeah, but that points fingers this way, then.
Well, that's what I'm pointing fingers at, is generally we have made our own traps there, and we have to rediscipline ourselves first.
Yes.
And as we do that, we can retrain them, too. Because if we don't have the ability to retrain ourselves, how in the world do we expect we're going to be able to retrain them?
All right, there's the concept. Right on. Now, get it. Let's make it practical.
Sometimes you get a student from another teacher that has fattened the duck, and you need to lean up.
Mm-hmm.
John. I agree with what he said. But we have students then that say, well, if you're not going to help me find this, I'm just not going to do it. That is an attitude issue, but you're just going to let them, and they will. They'll just continue. They don't care if they get a bad score or not. And parents aren't aware of it or don't care. I don't know what the situation is, but how do you deal with that? Because we run into that attitude.
For sure. I've had students play on my heartstrings when they say, well, you're the teacher. You know, oh boy, now what are you going to do? Well, yeah.
Because I had a student last year who was very, very good at that. Hand go up, I don't know how to do it. It's like, well, we just did this.
Yep.
You do know how to do it. We did it yesterday. Don't know how to do it. They just don't know how to do it. Most frustrating thing for me.
Here's what's going to happen if you have Rod and Staff math in about 7th grade, 6th grade. They're going to go across these lessons at the beginning on, you know, basic addition. And they're going to have huge numbers, you know, ones that are, you know, 100,000s plus 100,000s plus 100,000, about 5 of those in a row. And then they're supposed to check them. And they're just coming out of summer. Okay, so I have the students come up to my desk, or they have their hand up in the air. This problem doesn't check. Yeah? Okay. So there you have it. What are you going to do? You're going to start doing the work for them? You're going to feed the duck? Okay. I feel terrible. I usually say something. Oh, I see the problem. No, really? Yeah, do you want me to circle it for you? Yeah, circle it. Okay. And I go like this. Everything's inside the circle. Sorry, Doc. You know? Okay, that was a specific one. Here's another specific one. Answer the question with a question. They're asking a question, you ask a question. Okay, don't just right away trot out the tasty cakes. Okay? Answer the question with a question. Get them thinking. Another thing you can do is, okay, well, where did, well, let's back up. You know, especially in these how-to lessons that are sequential. Let's move up to, previously in the sequence. Well, I can see you were doing the right work here. Right? So how were you doing this? And or what part don't you understand? Or start working it at the board and I'm having my stuff here and I'll just keep an eye on you. And, well, they'll finish the problem. You know, that can happen. And if they could do it on their own, well, surely you wouldn't want to do it for them. Mm. Is there more about that or anything else?
If you can somehow compile truth evidence against them, like if you can get them to the one time where you say, yeah, just erase and do it again, until they finally actually do it and get it right, then you have your proof against them for the next time.
Okay.
Say you did it before.
Yeah, maybe another way to spin that would be is to help them savor the victory. You know, when they've actually done something. So often students are so driven to get done with their assignment that they don't take time to relish or actually think about what they've actually done. And if we can stop, think, there's something to be said for yelling after the walls fall down, like they did when they compassed the walls of Jericho. All right. Let's not get developed this thing of we're so... excited about things that we can't, rejoice in the victory and see how we've actually accomplished this. And each victory will help you some other to win. And the way that works is some by relishing the previous victory.
I tell my students, depending on, you know, if it was grammar, they had charts or sketches, you know, to work from. So this is the logical process you go through to diagram a sentence. Mm-hmm. These are the questions mm-hmm. you ask at these points. So if they came up with a diagramming problem, it's like, okay, step number one, identify. Step number two, you know, have them tell me how they did what. Mm-hmm. And you'll soon find their flaw in their logic. Mm-hmm. And like right there, you're making a mistake. And, you know, they're on the way again. But they're also not just getting a free ride out of you.
No, that's right.
And if they keep coming up with these questions, after a while, you tell them, okay, now what are you supposed to be doing? How do you do it?
See, and what that requires of us is we must be sequential in our teaching and clear in our teaching so that they know what sequence to go through.
Right. So let's take this question to something like history or Bible, where you've got a portion that you have to read, you've got a series of questions you have to answer, and they do 8 of the 10 questions, and they say, I can't find questions 6 and 10. So, do you just tell them, read again? Or do you say, well, I can't find it either, or look on, you know, between here and here? Or how do you deal with that, especially if you're dealing with students who have issues, time issues, which relates to homework issues and work, and, you know, make them read 8 pages in science again when they read stuff they don't really care about and have a hard time understanding? It's a pretty tall order, it seems like. But what's the best approach?
All right, you heard the question. What do you do?
This is not a math or an English question. This is right. What we're talking about reading.
It's not a how-to lesson. It's not a, this is more of a study skills lesson.
My classic question in return to them was, where do you think it'll be found?
There you go. That's one of the things that went through my mind, too. Where do you think it might be found? Now, obviously, it's not going to be in all 8 pages. All 8 pages, not like the candidate. Narrow it down to 3 once. Mm-hmm. Another thing I like. Oh, yes.
In response to that, most of the textbooks are set up, the questions are sequential. Mm-hmm. If you found 5 and 7, mm-hmm. you know about where 6 is going to be.
Right.
And you know that kind of an answer. The way I used to do is, maybe John remembers, I found it last night in my study. I mean, maybe I would give them a page number, you know, flip to it quickly and give them a page number. Now, you study it out, because I have the answers there. You're smart enough with it. I mean, some of CLE's books, the answer wasn't there. I have to admit, there was a couple of times I could not find the answer. I found the answer key, and I still couldn't find it in the textbook. So you need to be aware of those too, and that's where my study ahead of time came in handy sometimes. I just skip those questions.
All right. Another way of using that same thing is asking the other, throw it out to the class. You know, John here is having a problem with number 8. Did anyone find the answer to that? Yeah. Oh, okay. So just the fact that you know there was another duck that had its head under the water at the right place and came up with some krill or whatever. That's in its own way encouraging and
it's
motivating.
Also positive peer pressure.
Yes.
If they can do it, I can do it too. And I don't want to look dumb and say I can't find it, so I guess I can find it after all.
Right.
Yeah. But I think there's a time to stick to your guns too. I know if you know your student is smart, if you know, you have to do it after reading it all again. I'm like, I've told them before, you have to read it 50 times. If you can't find it the first time, mm-hmm. or you'll rate it till you find it. If it's up to 50 times, it's just absolutely mind is shocking how quickly. Oh, right, it's right there. Oh, yeah. And so, I mean, if they're actually struggling and you know under a load, then that's not how you do. But if they're just floppy and lazy and not trying to engage their brain, then just say, well, you can spend the rest of the week right there until you find
it. Or let them get it wrong. There's worse things in the world than getting one wrong.
But then what do you do when you have the one that doesn't care to get it wrong?
Yeah.
That's an attitude problem. That's an attitude problem.
And then you be patient.
And what you do.
See, that's where I think we need to make a dividing line. Is this an attitude issue? Mm-hmm. Or is this an inability issue?
Yeah, that's right.
You're and sometimes, you know, if they come, they're like, I think it should be on this page, and they give you the reason, you're like, boy, you're wrong. It's going to be on this page. That gets them back into the ballpark. You know, if they have actually been thinking about it, they will have some kind of maybe wrong logic, but some kind of tried answer.
And that's better, isn't it, if they come to you and say, well, my reasoning, I should find it here, but I can't find it here. The mind's working. It's not just saying, oh, I can't find it.
No.
Show me where it is.
I want to end with another appeal to compassion. Okay? I want to think about how Jesus Christ relates to us. Does he only teach you? Does he only teach me? Does he only accept me on the basis of that I'm so willing? Or that I am because of who I am? God chose me? No. God set his love upon us when we were unlovely. And we're still unlovely. But he still keeps working and working and working and working with us. God blesses us so much that we're like a fish in a fishbowl that doesn't even know it's wet. If you ask a goldfish, are you wet? Uh-huh. Right? And that's about the way we are with the way God blesses us. And he's not doing that because we're so competent or because we're so lovely. He's doing it because he chose to set his love and his compassion and his patience and his understanding and his teaching. He chose to set that on us regardless of who we are. Praise God for that. Right? And in some respects, I care very much about who I have next year, but in some respects, I don't care who it is that I have next year as students. I can set my love upon them regardless of who they are, if I choose to do so, in the same way that Jesus Christ did for me. But it takes compassion, it takes patience, it takes having a heart for your students, and all of those are free for the asking, if you ask at the right place. God bless.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.